wanted to speak tonight about Dharma practice as a way of making our inner life safe. That over the course of a Dharma practice, one of the ways of talking about change is that our inner life feels more and more safe. The assumption in that is that usually, unless we make some effort to make the inner life safe, it's experienced at least a little bit as unsafe. That the very experience of being human feels unsafe. The very experience of having a mind and body feels unsafe. And we can really spend our whole lives essentially on the run from our experience. That's actually the default mode of how human beings live. That unless we're, for whatever reason, come to pause, we will basically live our lives from one running from one experience to another. Running away from some, distracting ourselves from others. Very deep kind of tendency to try and control our inner life. And some of what was being pointed to in that meditation around loving kindness, it's about love, but it's also about softening resistance to experience. So Dharma practice, meditation practice, is coming to pause and to see what we're running from. And what we often find is that what we've been running from is actually scarier when we're running than when we pause. You know that a wolf in sheep's clothing, right? Our inner life, to some extent, is more like a sheep in wolf's clothing. But we have to know that for ourselves. We have to pause deeply to begin to trust that we can handle our inner life, that we can come to terms with what it is to be human. So Dharma practice for a lot of people is initially kind of jarring. And it's probably part of why most people don't stay with it. Because if we don't hear the Dharma with the right ear, it's super depressing. Now, the Dharma is not depressing. It's a path of well-being and joy and freedom, but we have to hear it the right way. And this initial encounter with ourselves, this initial pause when we commit in some way to stop distracting ourselves, to bring attention to our life, is jarring. And I so want to encourage people and inspire people that it's okay to have this experience, to feel a little shaken by the practice, and to feel like we don't know exactly what we're getting into. This is Bhante Gunaratana. There you are, and I should say, this is from Mindfulness in Plain English, and it's he doesn't kind of mince words. There you are, and you suddenly realize that you're spending your whole life just barely getting by. You manage to make ends meet somehow and look okay from the outside. But there are those times when you feel everything caving in on you, and you keep those to yourself. Meanwhile, way down under all that, you just know that there's got to be another way to live. Some better way to look at the world, some way to touch life more fully. You click into it by chance now and then. You get a good job, you fall in love, you win a game, and for a while things are different. Life takes on a richness and clarity that makes all the bad times and humdrum fade away. The whole texture of your experience changes, and you say to yourself, okay, now I've made it, now I'll be happy. But then that fades too, like smoke in the wind. And what's tragic is that some people have this insight, they have this encounter with themselves, and come to the conclusion that either they're effed up or they need to set their sights higher. They just need to aim for more money or what, you know, beauty, name it. But the Buddha is asking us to have this jarring recognition of like, oh, it's not so safe to have my experience. I don't feel so safe. And not to blame ourselves for that, but to see that this is what happens when we're practicing distraction and practicing fear of our own inner life. And so we come into practice and we have some willingness to pause, and maybe a little bit of trust or confidence that this kind of pause is essential, in fact, for our well-being. That to come home to ourselves, we must know what we've been running from, the feelings and thoughts we've been running from. And so we have some confidence to stay with practice for at least a bit. And then we begin on this path of making our inner life more and more safe, of developing more and more confidence in our ability to be with experience, to receive experience in awareness. And so what creates this safety? What creates a safe world for ourselves? Well, first, the Buddha says that our conduct is required to create a sense of internal safety. And the instructions, the kind of moral precepts in Buddhism, are not commandments that we obey, but emerge out of our own wise seeing that it's not possible to be happy when we're harming others, harming ourselves. And in the moments of anger, of self-judgment or anger directed outwards, the anger kind of makes the promise that there is such a thing as a close-hearted happiness. But as we settle in to the stillness within, we see with more and more confidence that it's our own conduct has real effects on the internal environment in which we live. A lot of forgiveness practice, which Noah emphasizes a lot, is this effort to sort of diffuse the little bombs in our mind. Forgiveness for ourselves, forgiveness for others. That before we really feel like we've come to terms with our past, with where we've come from, there are these themes that have these deep emotional charges for us. And so maybe every time a certain memory comes up, every time you see a certain person, every time a certain feeling arises, there's a kind of emotional charge to it because of our history and how we're relating to our experience. And forgiveness practice is about diffusing these, draining all the energy out of those little knots in the mind. I had this very moving experience of an old roommate who, a dozen years ago, I was living with in a three-bedroom apartment with another friend, and he had alcoholism, and it was okay for a while, and then it escalated to the point where it was just not livable, and I had asked him to leave or to change his behavior. And he was angry with my request and defensive and really unwilling to take responsibility for it. And eventually, maybe a couple months later, he agreed and moved out. And we had very sporadic contact for years. And then recently, he contacted me to ask to get together. And sort of had some sense of what that was going to be. I knew that he was sober. So we took a walk, and he was making amends and asking forgiveness and coming to terms with that. And what he said was that it was actually the first time somebody was very direct with him about how out of control the drinking was. And he was very grateful for that and apologized for his behavior. And I hadn't been nursing a grudge with him, but he needed to say that to me to diffuse one of those little knots in the mind. Because I presume every time, up till then, every time we had contact, every time he thought about that period of his life, there's some pain. Some sense of the inner life not being safe. And so this practice of forgiveness is a way of coming to terms with the past and draining all those experiences that have charge for us. And as we do this, the heart mind is uplifted, becomes lighter, becomes safer to live with this mind, with this body. Now, as we practice meditation, we're essentially asking the question, what disturbs my peace of heart? People don't think of meditation like this. Usually people are have more a sense of it's to relax and to escape at some level. At least that's the public perception. But Vipassana mindfulness practice is really ask the question. We sit down and then the question is what creates unhappiness for me? What disrupts my peace? And you find out pretty fast. Now, we don't always learn the lesson of that. We don't always take the experiences that arise on the cushion and the chair as opportunities to understand what disrupts peace. But we're slowly digesting, coming to terms with everything that might make our inner life feel unsafe. And in this way, from this perspective, mindfulness shares, there's a lot of overlap with exposure therapy, which is commonly implemented in psychotherapy. And just to very briefly sketch this out, exposure therapy might be used if somebody were afraid of spiders, for example. And you would sort of make a list, a kind of hierarchy of how, level of distressing encounters with spiders. So first it might be writing the word spider down. Pretty low. Maybe seeing a picture, seeing a video, seeing a spider from a distance, getting in the same room as a spider, allowing a spider to walk on one's hand. And the process is slowly adjusting and acclimatizing to the anxiety that arises. And instead of running, opening the heart fully to the experience of jitteriness or panickiness. And it's like over time the heart adjusts in the same way that when you jump into a pool that's too cold, it's like very unpleasant at first, and then the level of distress comes down, we get comfortable. And so this may be a therapy for spiders and lots of things, actually, for traumatic memories. But mindfulness practice, we could say, is exposing the heart to everything. And it will all come up. If we sit enough, it all comes up. And we slowly find our peace with all the different aspects of our experience, all the different parts of our inner life. And we develop more and more confidence that we can receive in awareness the experience of craving, of anger, of joy. That we can become less and less reactive, more and more receptive, that the attention can open more and more to experience without reactivity. And so this process has a logic of its own, and meditation, people who have practiced over time develop more and more confidence in this unfolding, this acclimatizing, this getting used to the temperature of the water. Now, to do some of this work, we have to take actions. Not enough to simply practice. Not enough to do meditation retreats. To be careful with one's conduct. We actually have to do things. And we do them when we feel strong enough to do them. not this kind of commando mentality of pushing us, exposing ourselves to experiences prematurely before the heart can open. It's this dialectic of effort, of bearing down at times, and of easing up. But when we feel ready, I should not say that. We never feel totally ready to do things we don't want to. When we feel ready enough, when we feel enough confidence in our own goodness, enough stability in our attention, we can do some things that have to be done. And I don't know what those are for you. You probably do. Probably know some things that need to be done. Some aspects of the experience that need to be explored, some feelings or activities that we've been avoiding. And the pain of avoidance is a kind of numbed out detachment. We get so used to living in some avoidance that the pain is not sharp anymore. It's just flattens our sense of aliveness. And even though it's hard. Believe me, I know it's hard. The sense of kind of feeling invigorated and alive when we are ready to push into some aspects of our experience that have been walled off with some fear, it's so liberating. It's so enlivening. And so from my own life, had an experience recently that we'll share. And for me, in my life, there's always been a certain self-consciousness about my body. And a sense of just not total ease in my body. And that doesn't show up in many ways in my life. But it does show up in one example that sounds kind of silly, but it actually contains a lot for me. Dancing. Now, some of you dancers are like, how could anyone possibly suffer about that? But there's something about the spontaneity and the improvisational, you know, I feel super exposed. And to compound things, I am not a good dancer. And if I'm not careful, I'll just wind up running in place. So I've worked a bit on this. But Kate Sheila, who teaches dance, Five Rhythms dance here, did a day long, and I came. And it was clear, like, there's a lot for me to learn. It wasn't comfortable. It was clear that I needed, this was actually, even though it's a silly example, it's actually like a real part of my growth as a human being. And I don't know all the things it's tapping into exactly, but I know that it's really alive, and I want and felt ready to explore. So I went to this class in Topanga Canyon at this yoga studio, and I don't know much about the practice, but at some level it's about making physical one's own inner life, making that physical in the form of dance. And so we're starting out, it's maybe 10 people, this beautiful yoga studio, this wonderful music, and Kate is giving some instructions, and we're just kind of warming up dancing. And there's one person who I just notice is a just phenomenal dancer. She was just, I could see that she was so responsive to the music and so responsive to her own inner life that it was so striking to see how she was moving. And at times, it wasn't like she was always doing like elaborate moves or something. Sometimes she was just standing still or bouncing or something. Sometimes it was much more like you could tell, oh, she's a dancer. She also happens to be a former supermodel and 6 feet tall.
Where is this class?
I'm not telling you. This is what's happening. I'm trying to stay in my body, and I'm not feeling. There's moments of where I feel fine, and then moments of pretty intense self-consciousness. So everybody's kind of dancing, and it's beautiful. People are not sort of like looking around at each other. Nobody's trying to pick anybody up. People are really just in their experience, a real spiritual practice. And then we get paired up. Yeah, I got paired up with her. And what happened next was really one of the most kind of precious Dharma experiences for me, of my life. I was, you know, it's intense. We're looking into each, this is the instruction, we're looking into each other's eyes. And I am feeling like a demented schoolboy. And she's this, you know, right? So, okay, but I can practice with that, right? I can practice, I think. And so I'm trying to open to what's happening and this exquisite sensitivity and a sense of being exposed as deeply as I'm ever exposed. And when somebody's that exposed, what they need most, what they depend on like a lifeline, like oxygen, is kindness. And she was so kind. She could see clearly that I was, there was a lot of self-consciousness and that that I just couldn't connect in with the spontaneity of the moment, that there was a sense, a very strong sense of I am-ness, of self. And she moved, she took it down a notch, more than one notch. She took it down. And she was kind of meeting me in what I could do. And she moved more slowly. And she really let me have my own experience. And over the course of that time, those minutes, it was like my heart kind of adjusting, getting used to that climate, to that emotional climate. Like getting used to water that's way too cold. And then we stopped in the movement and we were instructed to come into stillness, and she leaned her head against my shoulder and I leaned my head, my cheek against the top of her head, and we just stayed there in stillness. And in some ways the experience was really painful, right? But so much gratitude to her. Appreciate my own willingness to be exposed in that way, and a sense of real aliveness. And a lot of our change, a lot of the change that we are being asked to make, is going to take us off solid ground. It's going to require us to tolerate the feelings of awkwardness and exposure. But this is part of making our inner life safe. And honestly, I'm not interested in learning how to dance, but I want to feel safe in my experience. And so slowly we find ways of trying to practice courage and practice the willingness to be with. And the heart opens more deeply. It can hold more. We see that it can hold more. We can receive even very challenging experience. We can receive it in attention. It doesn't kill us. One last point around making our inner life safe. Coming to terms with loss. That we can't hold on to anything. That the world is always kind of slipping through our fingers. And naturally we cling, naturally. naturally we cling. But our inner life can't feel safe unless we've begun to come to terms with the changingness of this world, of ourselves. That nothing can be clung to. It's a poem from Leonard Cohen. And I don't know what all of it means, but there's something about coming to terms that with losing things. I used to be your favorite drunk, good for one more laugh. Then we both ran out of luck, and luck was all we had. You put on a uniform to fight the Civil War. I tried to join, but no one liked the side I'm fighting for. So let's drink to when it's over, and let's drink to when we meet. I'll be waiting on this corner where there used to be a street. I cried for you this morning, and I'll cry for you again. But I'm not in charge of sorrow, so please don't ask me when. I know your burden's heavy as you wheel it through the night. The guru says it's empty, but that doesn't make it light. So let's drink to when it's over, and let's drink to when we meet. I'll be waiting on this corner where there used to be a street. You left me with the dishes and a baby in the bath. You're tight with the militias and you wear their camouflage. Well, I guess that makes us equal, but I want to march with you. An extra in the sequel to the old red, white, and blue. So let's drink to when it's over and let's drink to when we meet. I'll be waiting on this corner where there used to be a street. It's gonna be September now for many years to come. Many hearts adjusting to that strict September drum. I see the ghost of culture with numbers on his wrist salute some new conclusion that all of us have missed. So let's drink to when it's over and let's drink to when we meet. I'll be waiting on this corner where there used to be a street. And so the heart begins to make peace with the fact that impermanence is the very ground of existence. And we do this not to depress ourselves or to feel grief, but to know the burden on the heart created when we deny impermanence, when we live as if things can stay the same forever. And so this is our work in living a life that feels safe. May we all feel safe.